Culture Affidavit, episode 163. J.S. April, the JSA versus Extant. Hello and welcome to episode 163 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panarese, and welcome to J.S. April. J.S. April, in case you haven't heard of it, is a podcast crossover event that celebrates the original superhero team, the Justice Society of America. Throughout April, a whole slew of podcasts and blogs will be covering different aspects of the JSA's 85-year history, from the Golden Age up until now. You can find a list of all the J.S. April material on the Fire and Water Podcast Network's website, which I linked to in this episode's show notes. Also, check out the hashtag J.S. April on your social media. I'm going to be covering one of the Justice Society's darkest hours, and then the redemption versus one of their greatest enemies, Extant. This will include a history of the character, as well as a look at his fight with the JSA in Zero Hour, and then the 2000 storyline, The Hunt for Extant, which was in the Geoff Johns written JSA series. And I'll get that started right after this.
Back in 1940, eight sensational heroes united to create the world's very first superhero team, the Justice Society of America. Now, 85 years later, we're gathering podcasters and bloggers from around the globe for a month-long celebration in an event we're calling J.S. April. Throughout April 2025, join dozens of all-star podcasters and bloggers as they each share their own unique tributes to the original and greatest superhero team, covering exciting topics like
Superman Family Number 211, October 1981.
Mr. and Mrs. Superman attend the wedding of Batman and Catwoman.
JSA Number 1 from 2024.
JSA 68 through 72.
All-Star Comics Number 58.
JSA Number 59 from 2004.
Justice League of America 171.
And Justice League of America 172.
The Legacy of the JSA Character Names.
The Brave and the Bold Number 61.
The Golden Age Wonder Woman JSA Adventure.
JLA JSA Virtue and Vice 2002.
DC Special Number 29 featuring the Untold Origin of the Justice Society.
Infinity Inc. Annual Number 1. JSA Number 38. And the Stargirl TV series.
Justice Society of America Number 6 from 1993.
Justice Society of America Number 20.
Justice Society of America Annual Number 1, 2008.
Justice Society of America Number 10 from 2007.
All-Star Comics Number 4 from 1941.
The Wonder Woman Spectacular from 1978.
Celebrate with JSA 85th birthday cookies.
The 1987 Infinity Inc. and Outsiders specials.
Wanted, the world's most dangerous villains Number 6 from 1973.
The recent Alan Scott Green Lantern miniseries.
Examining the role of the Justice Society in the crisis.
And the effect the crisis had on the team.
More Fun Comics 55 from 1940.
Contrasting the Justice Society of America versus Marvel's Invaders.
In Post-Crisis, how the JSA inspired the JLA.
Justice League of America Number 29 through 30, plus The Flash Number 123.
Golden Age Origins Number 1.
Showcase number 97 to 99 from 1978.
The Justice Society versus Extant.
All-Star Squadron, issues 19 and 20 from 1983.
All-Star Comics, issues 60 to 63.
JSA number 56 through number 58 from 2004.
JSA, the Liberty File.
Justice Society of America, thy kingdom come.
And that's just some of the topics that will be covered during the celebration. Get ready for a thrilling month of beloved characters, fascinating insights, and incredible stories. Follow the action on social media with the hashtag JSApril, and visit our website for a complete list of participating podcasters, bloggers, and what they're each covering at fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSApril.
There's not much to my personal history with the Justice Society of America. I first heard about their existence in The Brave and the Bold number 182, where Batman went to Earth 2 to team up with Robin, and there was a reference to the team. Later, I would collect Crisis on Infinite Earths through my LCS's back issue bins, and then I would gather up as many crossover issues as I could, plus the history of the DC Universe. At that time, the JSA wasn't active. This was like 1990, 1991, when the team was still in exile. There was a flashback miniseries or a miniseries that took place, I believe, in the 1940s, back in like about 1992. And then they would return to action after a miniseries that spun out of the crossover event that created Extant, Armageddon 2001. If you were a DC Comics reader in 1991, you saw house ads all over the place for that summer's crossover event, Armageddon 2001, which was a mystery that began in the future and ended with a fight in the present day as Wave Rider, a time-traveling hero from the 21st century, traveled back to 1991 to determine which of our superheroes was destined to betray and kill all of his fellow heroes to take over the world and become Monarch. The crossover began in Armageddon 2001 number 1, and the mystery of who is Monarch played out throughout most of the DC annuals of the summer as Wave Rider visited the heroes and looked into their futures just by touching them, looking at who they were going to be in 2001, and then it ended in Armageddon 2001 number 2. The last of the annuals in the crossover was Justice League Europe, that showed a time-tossed JLE in various places and times because of an accident that occurred around 2001. I want to say that the cat had something to do with causing it. At any rate, everyone had been touched except for Captain Atom, who had not been at headquarters for the entire issue and whose own series had concluded with him fighting and defeating his evil twin. Armageddon 2001 number 2 opens with Wave Rider looking into Captain Atom's future and seeing him going crazy and using his powers to destroy the better part of a city. It's clear that he is supposed to become Monarch. And that was supposed to be the case. Except the secret of the crossover was leaked at some point in the summer of 1991. And at the last minute, the identity of the character was changed. This was an idea brought about by Titans editor John Peterson, who is quoted in an interview in the Titans Companion as saying, "Dick Giordano was beside himself, and one day I was at lunch with Dick and Jerry Ordway, and suddenly I had this idea. What if we change the ending? I thought it would be this great stunt. Let everyone think they know the ending, and we'll create a secret finale and a dummy finale. Even the people at DC would see this dummy copy trafficking around, and Dick thought the idea was just crazy enough to work, so that's what we did." The new identity of Monarch, by the way? Hawk, of Hawk and Dove, whose secret identity is Hank Hall. That series had just ended as well. According to Peterson, quote, "Hank was this warlike guy anyway. You could just push him off the deep end, bring him to the dark side, and that would be the tragedy, that Wave Rider's interference would ultimately be the event to cause Hawk's transformation." So in the middle of the confrontation with Captain Atom, Monarch shows up and disrupts everything. Then he kidnaps Dove and kills her in front of Hawk. Hawk attacks and kills Monarch, ripping his mask off to reveal the face of Hank Hall. Hawk more or less snaps and decides to put on Monarch's armor. And if I'm being honest, that moment still doesn't register well because it's such a weird left turn. Maybe if we'd seen the change happen a little more slowly with Chaos taking him over. We can get into that a little bit later. The heroes battle Monarch in Metropolis, and he and Captain Atom are thrown back in time to the era of the dinosaurs. And this leads to the miniseries Armageddon, the Alien Agenda, where Monarch and Captain Atom jump through time, fighting one another. And incidentally, by the way, the other spin-off miniseries from Armageddon 2001, which starred Wave Rider, Armageddon Inferno, brings the JSA back to Earth at the very end of that series. Neither of these series, by the way, I remember as being particularly great. The Alien Agenda, I think, was just kind of like fun in a, like the Superman Time and Time Again storyline that we would get because it's like, oh, it's a travel through time and fight. The Armageddon Inferno was just really bad. But at least it got us the JSA, and it would lead into the Justice Society of America series that was drawn by Mike Parabek that did not last as long as it should have. Captain Atom, by the way, would eventually return to the mainstream DC universe, and Monarch would not really be seen again until the very last page of Teen Titans number 20. That's where it's revealed that he has been the secret leader of the Teen Titans this entire time. That was a central mystery to the title. Who is the former Titan that got the Teen Titans together and then sent them back in time to kill Donna Troy, etc., etc.? Now, the Teamers were actually sleeper agents, and they would wind up fighting superheroes during Zero Hour when their brainwashing from Monarch kicked in. But what does this have to do with the JSA and with Extant? Well, Monarch is Extant, of course. And how did that happen? Well, you got to go to Showcase 94, number 8 and 9. It has a two-part storyline featuring Wave Rider and the Linear Men that's written by Dan Jurgens with art by Frank Fosco. Wave Rider and Rip Hunter go looking for Monarch and walk right into an ambush where Wave Rider touches him and realizes he's more than we ever knew before Monarch knocks him out and takes him prisoner. Monarch's objective is to create the world he was supposed to rule, and he needs their powers to do it. He hooks up a time travel device, and they start bouncing around time. Now, Rip Hunter is really confused by this, because Hawk was never smart enough to build something like this. And it's when Wave Rider attacks Monarch that all is revealed. Monarch siphons Wave Rider's coronal energy, and then explains that when the future Hank Hall killed Dove, consciousness merged with his and he became more powerful and way more intelligent. He uses the energy to transform himself into Extant and, of course, declaring, "I am Extant," and then steals Wave Rider's coronal wristband and vanishes. Hunter loses it because Wave Rider altered the time stream. Monarch was supposed to die fighting them that day. This leads us into Zero Hour. This is where Extant puts his plan into place to recreate the universe as entropy engulfs it from the extreme ends of the time stream. The creative team on this was Dan Jurgens on the writing of the pencils, and Jerry Ordway provided the inks. The damage to the time stream that Extant is causing has led to anomalies in the real world, like Batgirl operating in Gotham City when she was crippled in the Killing Joke, Hawkman having a number of different versions of himself appear, a young Dick Grayson teaming up with Tim Drake, Superboy fighting the classic Clark Kent Superboy in Smallville, and a host of other crossover stories. I'm not going into every detail of Zero Hour here. If you want to hear an outstanding podcast about the crossover, go over to the Fire and Water Network and listen to Zero Hour Strikes. Siskoid and Bass did a great, exhaustive and extensive look at the crossover, all of the ancillary books, and the Zero Month that followed it. It was a great run, and the entire series is available. I highly recommend listening to it if you're interested in Zero Hour. Now, I'm going to be talking about the JSA's role in Zero Hour, and they make a couple of appearances in issue number 4, which is actually the first issue because Zero Hour was numbered as a countdown title as opposed to from 4 to 0 instead of 1 to 4. So, in issue number 4, Hawkman fights Vandal Savage, and then several versions of him appear at once. Meanwhile, the Spectre turns down Wave Rider's help in this crisis. Issue number 3 begins with Vandal Savage, who by the way, is an immortal. He's been an immortal since the days of the caveman. He disappears because this time, his time where he came from has been erased. And then Wave Rider shows up to tell the members of the JSA that Wally West, the Flash, is dead. So after mourning the Flash, the team heads to Vanishing Point. Except for Hawkman and Hawkgirl, because of the events that go on in the Hawkman book, they'll merge him into like one character. It's all sorts of confusing. But when the JSA gets to Vanishing Point, they immediately run into Extant, who hits them with a coronal energy blast. He kills the Atom. He blasts Dr. Fate, seemingly killing him as well. The Sandman and Wildcat attack him, and he ages them instantly. Hourman and Dr. Midnight are next, and Hourman dies as a result. Wave Rider shows up and gets the fallen team in stasis as Extant kills the energy in Alan Scott's ring. It's then where Extant unmasks himself to reveal that he is Wave Rider? Well, he's combined Hawk, Dove, and Wave Rider's powers, which is something we will see in a later issue of the series. The JSA arrives back on Earth defeated and aged. At least two of them are dead. Dr. Fate is missing. Wildcat had a heart attack. Sandman and Dr. Midnight are dying from extreme old age. Ted Knight, Starman, said he is going to retire. Alan Scott gives Kyle Rayner his Green Lantern ring. And Jay Garrick rips off his costume's lightning bolt and says his days as a Flash are over. We see Jay and Alan again in the hospital in New York, where they find out that Wildcat and Sandman will more than likely make it, but Dr. Midnight has passed. Jay heads to Gotham as the world begins to fade away to get the help of the Spectre, and after Jay fades away, the Spectre swears vengeance. In New York, Ted Knight hands off the mantle of Starman to his son David, whom we will see become Starman for a quick moment in the ongoing series that will follow. That's the one written by James Robinson and starring David's brother Jack after David is killed. And the last JSA-er to appear in the story is the Spectre, who fights Parallax, Hal Jordan, who is behind this whole thing the entire time, and he helps the heroes win and restart the universe. I can't remember if I've covered Zero Hour somewhere. I think I might have talked about it like back in 2014 when I did like 1994 in comics. I may have written about it in the Titans coverage I did years and years ago. I feel like I have. I feel like I've said over the years how I felt about it. Or maybe I just had it in conversations I thought I did in the podcast. Anyway, I can get into it a little bit now because it's probably been a while as it is. So Armageddon 2001 and Zero Hour have always been near and dear to me because they were formative for me in my DC Universe collecting experience. Armageddon 2001 was the very first crossover that I was ever on the ground floor for, and I remember that my friend Harris collected it along with me. We were about 13, 14. We had so many conversations about who could be Monarch. Like every annual that came out, we read it, we went back over it. It was really, really fun. And I'm really sure that we were disappointed when it came to be revealed as Hawk because we had figured out that it was Captain Atom. Nevertheless, after Armageddon 2001 number 2, I did follow both of the characters from the book, Wave Rider and Monarch, especially Wave Rider. I would read the solicits either in direct currents or eventually previews, and any time Wave Rider appeared, it was usually in a Superman book, I would get the book because I really thought the character was cool. And then the ads for Zero Hour started appearing, and I was intrigued. Like, what is this? This looks really interesting, even though it was just like very, very slight teasers. And then all the little things that were happening in the DC books, like Valor dying in his series and some things going on in Legion. And I was buying up as many little breadcrumb books that I could for what Zero Hour was going to be about. And in issue number 20, we saw the reveal that Monarch was the unknown leader of the Team Titans. And I was excited. I've been collecting the Team Titans since it started, which should come as no shock to anybody. I'm a huge Titans fan. I think I was like one of the three people who loved and still does have a love for that title, even as flawed as it is. And funny enough, so when Monarch got revealed as the leader, Harris and I wrote this lengthy letter to the Team Titans editors with like a breakdown of how it was possible that Monarch was the leader when Lord Chaos was in charge in 2001 in the Titans timeline and how Monarch could come to power in that regard. And it was just this whole, like, we spelled it out and we got like a blurb in the letter column of the last issue. I think they said something along the lines of, if we had awards we could give out, we would give one to you, but we don't, so we won't. But back to Zero Hour. So for me, the main series was, and really still is, not as good as the crossovers. And if I'm being honest, I could never fully buy the idea that Hank Hall could evolve the way he did. Or maybe I would have had it been shown more than told with regard to the Lords of Chaos and Order stuff. You know, perhaps that Dan Jurgens had taken some notes from Keith Giffen and the way he wrote Amethyst and Gemworld into the history of the Legion of Superheroes, or dipped into what was going on at that point and like with Dr. Fate. But I guess if you're going to take a B-level hero and power him up beyond what he was ever capable of, the whole quote-unquote order and chaos combined thing is a good idea. After all, if you go back to the actual Hawk and Dove annual that was a crossover for Armageddon 2001, there was a future character called Unity, which was the result of a combination of order and chaos that was used for good. I was really hoping they would use that in some way in Armageddon 2001 number 2 or somewhere down the line, because this is the, that's like if order won. And I guess Extant is if Chaos won. But that was dropped because it was, again, it was a Hawk and Dove annual that I think only the people who were collecting Armageddon 2001 ever really cared about. Still, turning Monarch into Extant was a good way to correct a wrong that I think a number of fans were still pretty bitter about. And it made the character more formidable for a Universal-level crisis as opposed to him being a second-rate Doctor Doom. Then again, anybody approaching Dr. Doom is a second-rate Dr. Doom, because there is only one Doom, Hail Doom. Hi, Alan. Anyway, when it comes to the JSA and Zero Hour, I have mixed feelings of how it was handled. Now, first, there's the Spectre. His role in this whole thing makes sense. I really haven't read a lot of Spectre in my lifetime. Maybe a few old things, a couple of the issues of the John Ostrander series. But I get the feeling that by the time of this point in the post-crisis DC universe, that Spectre was more or less separated from the Justice Society. He had his own series. He was around the DCU while the heroes were imprisoned. And those writing him leaned into the God's Agents of Vengeance part of thing, making him more than just kind of the human Jim Corrigan with the ghost identity. In fact, when Jay Garrick goes to see the Spectre, he tries to appeal to that Jim Corrigan part of him, but the Spectre mentions that Corrigan is more or less dead. It gave me Alan Moore jettisoning the Alec Holland aspect of Swamp Thing. Plus, the Spectre makes sense in this book because he is powerful enough to take on Extant or Parallax, because he took on the Anti-Monitor in Crisis on Infinite Earths, and he played a similar role in the rebooting of the DC universe. Although in this case, the rebooting of the universe is intentional. In the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths number 10, he's simply trying to stop the Anti-Monitor from doing the reboot. And the fact that one universe was created as we opened Crisis number 11 was an inadvertent effect of that battle. But for the rest of the JSA in this series, well, there's the whole Hawkman issue, which, like I said, still confuses the heck out of me. I remember it being one of the major continuity problems of the post-crisis world. And I've read Hawkworld, and I've read bits and pieces of the Hawkman series from the 90s, the one that followed Hawkworld. But I'm still finding it confusing, and I'm not going to touch it right now. I might actually just go back and read it and try to make sense of it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to move on to the main thing that everyone remembers about the Justice Society of Zero Hour, and that's the fight against Extant and then their deaths. It has always bothered me that the JSA was never given much of a fight when it came to the battle with Extant. Had there been a much larger battle, they made it harder for Extant to win. Their deaths and retirements would have felt better. Instead, they were cannon fodder. And I get that it shows how powerful Extant had become and that everyone should take him seriously, but it's way too big of a moment to get just a few pages. This could have been something that got a few pages in Zero Hour and then maybe a longer, like 48-page special. It didn't need to happen so quickly with barely any breathing room. Now, Dan Jurgens tries to give it some gravitas, and I'll give him credit for that, but the torch being passed moments feel hollow, as do a lot of the emotional beats of this series. I personally think that's because the book was a weekly thing designed to fit into one summer month when it could have been a Crisis on Infinite Earths level monthly crossover that was a little more intricate. But this team, the original superhero team, got the heave-ho, and for what? To show that Hank Hall wasn't messing around? In the very least, it did set up Extant as that much bigger villain for both that story and for the JSA if they ever came back. And they would. But it would take 6 years. Characters from the JSA made appearances in various books throughout the mid to late 90s and would eventually be reunited in their own book. Extant would show up in that book, but he has one other appearance because he's really not seen again after Zero Hour except for flashback references. until the prestige format one-shot Impulse, Bart Saves the Universe. And I'll talk about that one after this break. Stick around.
Back in 1940, eight sensational heroes united to create the world's very first superhero team, the Justice Society of America. Now, 85 years later, we're gathering podcasters and bloggers from around the globe for a month-long celebration in an event we're calling JS April. Throughout April 2025, join dozens of content creators as they each share their own unique tributes to the original and greatest superhero team, including all-star podcasters and bloggers like
Justice Society presents
the Lombox Crusade Podcast,
Campus Comics Cast,
Supergirl Comic Box Commentary,
The Quarter Bin Podcast,
The Bat Pod,
The Earth 2 Podcast,
FW Team Up,
Diana Prince is the New Wonder Woman,
Fanholes Podcast,
Back to the Bins,
Coffee and Comics,
The Huntress Podcast,
*51.blogspot.com,
Justice Society Origins, a part of John Reed's Comics,
DC Special Cast,
Between the Pages Blog,
The Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast,
A World on Fire, an All-Star Squadron podcast,
JLA Stories and Friends,
The Monitor Tapes,
A Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast,
Lords of Order, a DC's Dr. Fate fan podcast,
David M. Gallagher at Medium.com,
JSA in the 90s,
Justice League Legacies,
DC Secret Files podcast,
Mike's Geek World,
Pop Culture Affidavit,
The Source Material Comics Podcast,
That Giffen Show,
Worst Collection Ever,
The Fantastic Four,
It All Comes Back to Superman.
And that's just some of the podcasters and bloggers who'll be joining in the celebration. Get ready for a thrilling month of beloved characters, fascinating insights, and incredible stories. Follow the action on social media with the hashtag JSApril, and visit our website for a complete list of participating podcasters, bloggers, and what they're each covering at fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSApril.
Impulse, Bart Saves the Universe, was released in 1999. The writer is Christopher Priest, the penciler is Todd Knock, the inker is Edwin Rozelle. Willie Schubert handled the type design and badass did the colors and letters. We open in 1941, where Extant takes out the JSA, but the Linear Men arrive to stop him and imprison him back at Vanishing Point. But Max Mercury, who is weak but still conscious, says it's a trap. In the present, Bart Allen, a.k.a. Impulse, who had been looking for someone to team up with, is in the Flash Museum when Rip Hunter appears and tells him that he's got to go back to 1941 and save the universe. That night, after a lecture from Max Mercury about needing to grow up, Bart falls asleep and wakes up in a world where nobody knows who he is, even Wally or a now-still-alive Barry Allen. There are no Flashes, and Bart does not know what to do. Max Mercury then shows up the same way that Rip Hunter did earlier, saying that Bart has to defeat Extant. Max gives a recap of who Extant is and then explains that when the Linear Men saved a bunch of bystanders after Extant's fight with the JSA back in 1941, they wound up saving a physicist named Dr. Edwards, who went on to create a doomsday weapon that the U.S. military tested out near the moon. It stopped the moon orbit for about a second, and that had a domino effect on the history of the DCU. Avenger crash landed in a different place and never gave his ring to Hal Jordan. Kal-El's spaceship landed in Uganda, and Barry Allen missed being struck by lightning by a split second. Max tells Barry that Bart needs to travel back in time to fix things, and then he dies. Bart then enters the time stream and goes back to September 1941 and crashes a JSA meeting. Max, the Max Mercury of 1941, that is, finds him. Then, after the Justice Society members notice that the Spectre is acting weird, Extant appears and attacks. He sees Bart and knows that the kid doesn't belong there. Bart runs off in search of Dr. Edwards, and the battle from the beginning of the story plays out, but Bart is able to keep Rip Hunter from saving Dr. Edwards' life. Extant turns his fury on Bart. Bart realizes that because he's a time anomaly himself, Extant can't harm him the way that he harmed the JSA. So he fights the villain and wins by grabbing his cape and pulling it around his crotch, kind of like giving him a big wedgie. Extant falls and the Linear Men once again take him prisoner, and the timeline is restored. I originally wasn't going to put this in my episode as like a whole coverage thing. I was only going to mention the story because I remember that Extant made an appearance and it was one of his few appearances before that JSA storyline. But I went back and read it and, oh, the Justice Society was in it. So I decided to give it some coverage. I bought this when it came out because Extant was in the book and the premise sounded pretty cool, I think. I mean, it was 25 years ago and I really haven't read this in a number of years and was surprised that the Justice Society actually had a role because I'd completely forgotten it. Basically, what this story is Impulse doing a fun take on The City on the Edge of Forever. The heroes, in this case Rip Hunter, save someone whose actions more or less start a ripple effect that would forever change history. In that Star Trek episode, it's the Nazis winning World War II because Edith Keeler lived. Here, it's the opposite. It's the development of a doomsday weapon that winds up preventing the Justice League from ever coming to pass. Bart Allen as Impulse was always the goofball character, and I liked that about him. In fact, I'm not the biggest fan of his Kid Flash transformation in the pages of Teen Titans, even though that did have some very good moments. Anyway, this is a purely fun one-shot, and Christopher Priest seems to know exactly where to put the comedy without it seeming too silly, but also doesn't try to make it too serious either. There's a temptation for a character like this to have that I need to be serious now moment. It's kind of here, but not fully. Priest knows the tone of Impulse, and I like that. And while it shows Extant as a formidable foe, I like how Bart takes him down with a wedgie. Comics were really fun back in the late 90s, and they would get dark in the following decade. Now, we've seen that pendulum swing a little bit back and forth over the last 10 or 15 years, and we've seen creators and companies not afraid to have fun with their characters from time to time. Granted, lately, it's like all Harley Quinn at DC, but it would be cool to see the return of Impulse or a character like him and a more lighter toned book. I felt that sometimes with DC, there's stuff that is really serious, and then there are other books that do have some joy to them. Tom Taylor's Nightwing really had that and balanced it really well. And what I've read of the Superman books in the last few years has had a lot of that too. And I'm glad that everything is not crazy grimdark because it's tiring after a while. But let's get to the main event. And that is the next and more or less last major appearance of Extant. It's a three-part storyline called The Hunt for Extant, which ran from issue number 13 to number 15 in the JSA series, the publication dates being August, September, and October of 2000. They were released in June, July, and August of the same year. The creative team for the storyline is David S. Goyer and Jeff Johns, writers, Steven Sadowski, pencils, Michael Baer, inks, Kenny Lopez, letters, John Calise, colors, and the editor was Peter Tomasi. The story is seated a couple of issues earlier. In JSA number 11, we open with a plane crash that is orchestrated by the Cobra cult. On board the plane is Adam Smasher's mother, and her death is the catalyst for a story that involves the team going after Cobra. Something that also hints at Extant is up to something is the return of Sylvester Pemberton, the deceased Star-Spangled Kid, whose presence causes our man to say that different timelines are converging and Extant is behind it. This causes members of the team to board our man's time ship and warp inside the time stream, much to Extant's delight. The rest of the team fights and defeats Cobra, and at the end of issue number 2, the time ship crashes into the roof of the JSA headquarters. The team members who are at HQ are greeted by the new god Metron, who says, "Our man and the rest of your teammates are dead. Unless you come with me now, the universe will cease to exist in approximately 12.89 seconds. That leads us into JSA number 13, part 1 of The Hunt for Extant, which is titled Time's Assassin. We open with Mr. Terrific introducing himself through narration boxes, as well as recapping that minutes ago, our man's time ship crash-landed on the roof of JSA headquarters, Metron apparently being the only survivor. Those members who remain are on the ship, and Metron recaps that the heroes had found him floating in the time stream without his Mobius chair. They bring him on board and say that Extant is responsible for what happened to him. He hijacked the chair so that he could get on his quest to reassemble Araman's Whirligog, which is, according to him, quote, the ultimate coronal effect. A map of space-time, and what Extant wants to do with it is use it to reshape space and time. Star Spangled Kid, who again is a bit of a time anomaly himself, because that character died toward the end of Infinity Incorporated back in the 80s when Solomon Grundy attacked him, asks who Extant is, and we get a recap of his origin as well as Zero Hour. And that's when Extant shows up, riding the Mobius chair. He starts firing at them and tries to DH Wonder Woman. And I'll just take a moment to note that this is not Diana. This is Queen Hippolyta, Diana's mother, whom had served as both the Golden Age Wonder Woman as well as the JSA's Wonder Woman in the early 2000s until her death in Our Worlds at War. But his coronal attack doesn't work because she's immortal. She can't age. She's able to get close to him and drives her sword through his chest. He is still alive, however, and manages to escape. Our man notes that Extant has headed for the end of time, and just after saying that, Dr. Fate removes his helmet and says that the voice of Naboo has been silenced. Metron starts talking about how bad their chances are, but Sentinel doesn't want to hear it because they need a plan to defeat Extant. As he starts to talk about what they can do, Extant attacks again, saying that he's doing this for the good of humanity and will create the perfect universe using the Whirligog. The JSA retaliates and Extant beats Flash, erasing the day he got his powers and making him just Jay Garrick. He boasts that he can just erase a day at whim and blasts the helmet of Naboo off of Fate's head, as well as erases Hawkgirl's immortality. Sentinel creates constructs of the three JSA members that Extant killed in Zero Hour. They attack, as does Star Spangled Kid, who tries to coach Stargirl through the battle. But Extant overpowers all of them, apparently obliterating them from existence and then creating a new universe for himself. Metron takes the ship and escapes to JSA headquarters. Then, with the remaining JSAers back in the time ship, they head to what is now the universe, according to Extant, and come upon a medieval-looking world where Knights of Order and Chaos, whose armor looks like Hawk and Dove's costumes, are fighting in a battlefield in front of a medieval castle. This leads us into part two, Chaos Theory, which is narrated by Sandman, a.k.a. Sanderson Hawkins, who took the Sandman mantle from Wesley Dodds. The team is on the medieval battlefield and fighting against the knights. They manage to get them to retreat, and Metron talks about how low their chances are for victory. Sandman shows the team that they have Dr. Fate's amulet, which according to Metron gives them a little bit more of a chance. Elsewhere, the JSAers who were supposedly erased from existence wake up on a farm, and Dr. Fate tells them that they are inside the amulet, which is where he transported all of them before they were killed. They are in there with Kent Nelson, the original Dr. Fate, and they are there to recoup and plan. The problem with planning, though, is that Extant is currently omnipotent, so he'll see them coming from no matter how they plan. Kent tells Dr. Fate, and by the way, just a clarification here, too, the Dr. Fate operating in this JSA is Hector, and there's a whole story there. It involves Infinity Incorporated. It even dips into Neil Gaiman's Sandman series. But here Kent is advising Hector and tells him that there's someone who can help him, Mordru. Yes, the Legion of Superheroes villain, Mordru. He's much younger than he shows up as in the 30th century, and right now he's currently imprisoned by Dr. Fate. Back in the other universe, the main universe, Mr. Terrific tells the team that all of the chaos energy floating through the air is affecting some of their science and technology, and it's not going to work the way it should. Dr. Fate visits Mordru, who taunts him and makes him take off his helmet, but then tells him the Clockwork Man is the key, and explains that Extant doesn't have all of the Whirligog because our man kept a segment of it for himself. So that means that there is a small flaw in Extant's plan, which is that new map of space and time, and it can be exploited. He also mentions Dove, who can provide a good distraction to Extant. Hector says that Dove is dead, but Mordru points out that Extant recreated the universe and surely brought Dove back to life. Hector thanks Mordru and puts the helmet back on. Before they part, Mordru taunts him again by saying he knows where Hector's wife, Lyta, who was Fury and an Infinity Inc. teammate, is. The other team members search through the castle in the land, and they find the Mobius chair. Metron tries to get it back, but suffers from a power feedback of some sort. And then Extant, who is in a new snazzy costume that is silver and red with a star field and parts of his torso and cape, comes at him. Atom Smasher charges at Extant, but it's still no use, and they fall. Extant sees that Starman, Sandman, and Mr. Terrific are still standing. Then, Dr. Fate shows up with the JSA members in tow. They all attack except for Stargirl and Dr. Midnight, who find a blonde girl chained up in a castle dungeon. Seeing that they are there to rescue her and help her bring things back to order, she says, "Dove," and turns into her heroine identity. Part 3 is our conclusion, and it is called Crime and Punishment. It's narrated by the Star-Spangled Kid. In the castle, Dove and now the fully assembled Justice Society of America confront Extant. Dove takes a blast meant for our man. She then appeals to the Hank Hall within Extant, but he kills her and blasts her body, saying that he was never Hank Hall, but was always Extant. Black Canary is horrified that only did Dove die, but Dr. Fate knew it, and he brought her back anyway. But he says that she knew what they were doing, which was giving them an emotional distraction to work with. Our Man then gives each team member a bit of his power and sends them throughout the timeline to battle Extant. They fight throughout history, with Wildcat fighting him among the dinosaurs, Sentinel wearing the same armor we saw him wear in Kingdom Come, Hawk Girl fighting him during World War II, Mr. Terrific fighting him in what looks like the future, and other fights with Starman, Sandman, Stargirl, The Flash, Star-Spangled Kid, Black Canary, Dr. Fate, Our Man, Atom Smasher, Dr. Midnight, and Wonder Woman. The one who gets the upper hand is Atom Smasher, who rips the Whirligog off of Extant's wrist, taking away his power and causing the universe to heal itself and revert back to its natural state. This means that Star-Spangled Kid, who of course was from an alternate timeline, starts to fade away. He has a heartfelt moment with Stargirl, and then he dissipates. Extant tries to escape and creates a time tunnel. Atom Smasher jumps in after him, as does Metron, who wants to use the Whirligog to redirect Extant's flight throughout time. Atom Smasher doesn't want to do that just yet, because he wants to be able to save his mother from dying. Metron says that altering time might be foolish, but Atom Smasher will not take no for an answer. Metron then asks, "What do you propose?" And we cut 3 days ago on the plane that was carrying his mother, just as it was going to explode. Terry Rothstein begins to glow, and a moment later is replaced in her seat by Extant, who realizes what's going on, right as he is and the other 216 people on board the flight die in the explosion. Albert holds his mother in the time stream, and they all return to headquarters. Metron now has the Whirligog. Our Man acknowledges that he failed to act when the time called for it. Metron gets on his chair and leaves. Our Man, who sees his latest failure as part of a pattern, decides to quit. Then Jack Knight leaves. Starman, by the way, was on issue number 70 at the time, which was the tail end of the storyline that killed off Jack's father, Ted, and he would soon retire as a hero himself. Hippolyta leaves, as well as Atom Smasher and Dr. Fate, leaving behind Sandman, Sentinel, Hawkgirl, Wildcat, Dr. Midnight, Black Canary, Mr. Terrific, Flash, and Stargirl. They stand in the cemetery, the graves of Rick Flagg, Celsius, Golden Eagle, and Prince Rahman behind them, looking at the memorial statue of the original Dr. Midnight, Our Man, and Atom. Stargirl lays a rose on the memorial, and we get the closing narration. "We lost so many in those first few years. Family, teammates, but we also managed to save the world a dozen times over, the universe even, sacrificing whatever we had to, without question or remorse. That's what heroes did, and that's what heroes still do." Okay, full disclosure, I did not read this storyline until a couple of years ago. You know, as much as I followed Monarch and then Extant as a character back in the 90s, by the time 2000 rolled around, I was kind of half out of comics, or at least I was not paying attention to the larger DCU. I certainly was not reading JSA. I wasn't even reading JLA. It wouldn't be until I heard a mention of Extant's death, probably on a DC message board or something, that I heard about this storyline. Back then, you had to either hunt down the trade or back issues, and I didn't have the money nor access to a good enough comic store to do that. So I let things go, and I stuck with whatever I was reading. When I got my DC Infinite subscription, this was one of the storylines I looked at within the first few months. So I did get caught up, I guess. This is going to come off as one of the most backhanded compliments of all time, but reading this story reminds me of how good Geoff Johns was when he was at the top of his game. There would be a number of stories down the line, I think I mentioned the Teen Titans earlier in the episode, that would sour me on his writing, but here it's not only really good, but seems pretty fresh, even 25 years later. A few years prior to the JSA title premiering, Grant Morrison had launched JLA and brought that team and that book back to its place in the DCU as the premier superhero book. I got the impression that Johns was trying to do something similar with the Justice Society, and he pulls it off. But whereas the JLA series was all about power and defeating big threats, this seems to be more about legacy and, on some level, family. It also gets into the idea of dealing with the past and what effect it has on our children. As a villain in these issues, Extant is written as a bit over the top and mustache twirling, but if I'm being honest, that's the one thing he's always been right about the character, even when Dan Jurgens created him. Hawk was arrogant. He was hot-headed. And even though he absorbed Dove and that made him more powerful and smarter than Hawk, he's still that person on some level, so he's still going to be arrogant and hot-headed. And the use of Dove to not get him to turn back, but to provide enough of a distraction for the JSA to be able to make their move is a great story beat, especially since the last page of issue number 14 is Dove standing there wearing her costume. She's a character we hadn't seen in nearly a decade, so it's a great last page reveal. That makes me wonder, by the way, why Johns also didn't go for some reference or presence of Hank's brother, Don, because that would have really gotten to the core of Extant's emotions. Don's death at the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths made Hawk go off the rails until Don Granger came around, and there were a few mentions of him here and there during the late 80s and early 90s. I think it was the first Hawk and Dove annual where he was mentioned in the context of being able to bring back the dead. But Don has kind of become an Uncle Ben type of character in the DCU. He's someone who is so pure of an inspiration that his death has and probably will never be reversed. Even Geoff Johns knew this. It's why he's not able to come back as a zombie in Blackest Night. Anyway, back to this story. One thing that Johns does really well when he was in his prime, at least, was use DC's vast and often convoluted continuity to his advantage. Like I said, I wasn't that familiar with his JSA beyond a few issues here and there, as well as what I'd gleaned through reading the Jack Knight Starman series. But I had read some of both All-Star Squadron and Infinity Incorporated, and I could identify some of the legacy characters, mainly Atom Smasher and Hector Hall, the current Dr. Fate. They've got a pretty long backstories, as does Extant himself. There are pages of explanation of the villain's origin, which is something I think you need for newer readers who probably haven't read Zero Hour and aren't familiar with a villain that hasn't been seen in 6 years, and all of that is seamlessly woven into the story. I'll also give the credit to the artists for making the time stream fighting compelling. One issue I had with Zero Hour, and has always had with Zero Hour, is that the heroes just seem to be fighting with brightly colored backgrounds for a significant portion of the story. Sadowski and Bear give the time stream a rainbow swirl effect and are so dynamic with the action when it comes to the fight between the JSA and Extant in Part 1 that you really don't notice the lack of a concrete background. Even the times when they are standing around and talking to one another are well rendered and don't feel like a bunch of characters posing. When it comes to that first fight, though, before Extant flees and remakes everything, I appreciate that even though he is pretty much as powerful as he was back in the time he faced off against the Justice Society back in Zero Hour, this time around they put up a serious fight before they eventually fall. And they have to fall for the sake of the story. Hippolyta as the Golden Age Wonder Woman, by the way, great idea from this era. It's one of the few things I think John Byrne did really well in his Wonder Woman run. She drives her sword through him, and you might think that's a little aggressive, but it shows that she understands the magnitude of his threat, and she's prepared to use the appropriate level of strength. Johns also does a good job using common tropes for storytelling in this series. The Whirligog is kind of like the Infinity Gauntlet. You know, it's the all-powerful thing that you don't want in the wrong hands. And if I recall correctly, it's actually from the Grant Morrison JLA story. I want to say it's from the Rock of Ages storyline. Now, you combine that with a Mobius chair, which is always popping up in the DCU anyway, and you've got this powerful villain, it makes sense that he could be the threat that he is. The team doesn't die. Instead, shunted off into Fate's amulet. It's not revealed until later. That's another thing that we've seen before. And when it can come off as a bit cliche, I think he makes it work here. And I will also give him credit for seeding elements of the story a few issues prior. The obvious one is the plane crash. It happens at the beginning of issue 11. It's part of an entirely different storyline. Less obvious is having the team split into two for issue 13. So we have a formidable group of heroes ready to take on Extant after their comrades have fallen. John's avoids, which has become commonplace by then, one hero, usually the one perceived as the weakest, usually Batman, is the only one left standing, and they are able to rescue their teammates and thwart the villain's plan almost completely on their own. Here, the entire other half of the team is ready to go into battle. I liked that. And it saves us from a repeat of something we've seen before in titles like Grant Morrison's JLA. You know, that half of an issue of, here's how the world has changed. Extant creates a world that where he lives in a medieval castle, and it looks like the Warriors of Order and Chaos are locked in a huge battle, and he's ruling, and the team arrives and just starts fighting. And it makes sense. Extant is more or less Chaos himself. There's no time to kind of go around and look at things. Now, if you contrast that with the Rock of Ages storyline in JLA, it's where Darkseid takes over in an alternate future. That future is dystopian. Everyone is forced into obedience. The heroes fight in the shadows. For all of his evil, Darkseid is order. Twisted, evil order, but Darkseid is order. Despite the fact that Monarch was a similar character when he was introduced in Armageddon 2001 number one, because he was very much a big brother type, Extant has become something much different, and that allows our team to fight head-on and out in the open with him, because he is Chaos. The art, by the way, is so great, and I love seeing this whole fight play out. By the way, I just realized I never mentioned how awesome the cover art is. All three covers are by Alan Davis and Mark Farmer, and they just, I mean, they're beautiful, because when isn't Alan Davis and Mark Farmer's art not beautiful, right? Part two, we have that battle. It gets into a lot of talking, of course, with some explanation and planning, which is what you get in mid-part stories like this. Fate goes to Mordru, who made a prison a while ago. Mordru, of course, is a Legion of Superheroes villain, as I mentioned. In his younger years, was a villain in the post-crisis era of Amethyst. And credit where credit is due, by the way, to somebody I mentioned earlier, Keith Giffen. He did a soft reboot of Amethyst in the late 80s and tied her directly to the Legion in a way that paid off well in the 5YL timeline. Now, at this point, we're 6 years into the Legion reboot era, so the entire group of stories that took place in the late 80s and early 90s for the Legion is moot. But Johns clearly was picking up on something Giffen had laid down, and I liked that. I also like that Mordru taunts Hector with the whereabouts of his wife, Lyta. I mentioned earlier that I had some familiarity with Infinity Incorporated, and a while back I went and read some of the more important post-crisis issues from that book that dealt with Fury in the post-crisis era, as well as the retcon of her origin and the death of Hector Hall. That led to me jumping through various issues and storylines of Neil Gaiman's Sandman, because she was the person who's responsible for Morpheus's death. Daniel, who becomes Dream after Morpheus dies, is her child. Now, the Sandman ended about 5 years prior to this storyline, so I'll have to go back and see how we got from that to where we are now. I know that Fury shows up in Phil Jimenez's Wonder Woman, but that's about 6 months away from starting at this point, so maybe I'll dig into that a little more too. And the use of Dove? Great. She hadn't been seen for the better part of a decade, and her reveal at the end of part two was great drama. Her being more or less a sacrificial distraction is also well done. Granted, I guess you could say it's unfair to her to use her like that as a sort of woman in refrigerator moment, but it works well for the storyline. And a quick check of Hawk and Dove in their Wikipedia page shows that she does return much later in the series and that John uses Mordru as the impetus for that return and for Hawk's initial insanity that led to his being Monarch and Extant. I think I've got more JSA reading to do. When it comes to the final fight of each JSA member taking on Extant in various places and times, Sadowski and Bear render it as a multi-panel montage over three pages, until we get a splash page of Atom Smasher growing huge and holding the villain in his hand while ripping the Whirligog off of him. I like the pacing. I like how it crescendos to that splash page, which is how you use a splash page, something that had been forgotten throughout the early part of the 90s. And just like with Hippolyta running her sword through him in part one, Atom Smasher's decision to kill the villain by putting him in the plane crash is appropriate. I think it works incredibly well. His mother's death had an emotional impact a few issues earlier, and for once, we see someone get their wish to undo something tragic, despite any possible consequences. It's kind of like how Courtney Cox gets sent back in time to the moment before her parents take off for Catalina Island and Masters of the Universe. She's able to stop them from taking a plane trip that kills them, and it gives her character a happy ending. Our ending, with some members of the team leaving but the team not completely broken up, is well earned. Each character who leaves has a distinct reason for doing so, but we're still left with a group that is formidable and clearly committed to keeping the legacy of the team going. There's a good amount of pathos in the final pages in that last page, which is of the statue of their fallen comrades, makes me feel that this is something that was finally made up for or set right. Extant, by the way, never appears again. This is the beginning of a retcon of Hawk's story and eventually leads to both the return of Dove later in the JSA series as well as the return of Hawk himself at the end of Blackest Night. Hawk plays a role in the Brightest Day storyline and has shown up in Birds of Prey since then. This storyline was collected in the Darkness Falls trade paperback. It's available on DC Infinite and as a collection of the same name. If you haven't figured it out already, I highly recommend reading it. And I plan on reading more of this JSA title because it's really, really good. And that'll do it for my part of JS April. Take some time to go to the show notes and click the link that takes you to the master list of all the JS April podcasts and blog posts. It's been a great month of content. There's some great stuff out there for you to enjoy, both podcasts, blogs. It's really, really fun, and I highly recommend checking it out. As for me, I will be back in a month with something completely random, as usual. In the meantime, check out the blog for an occasional post or essay and send me an email or leave me a message on social media. And as always, thanks for listening and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is hosted and produced by me, Tom Panneries. The theme music is Pop Rock by Scott Holmes and is used under Creative Commons licensing. You can contact and follow me via email at popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. on Facebook and Instagram as Pop Culture Affidavit, and on Blue Sky as Pop Aff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. And of course, you can find episode links, show notes, and blog posts on my website, popcultureaffidavit.com. Thanks very much for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.